honoring our first poet laureate on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. We'll spend our time today celebrating Dick Stahl on Scribble. Hard to know how to do it, isn't it?
It is. It is. Well, for one thing, it's still, I have trouble wrapping my mind around it. You know, it's not right for students to die before their teacher. There's something wrong with the sequence there. And yeah. I spent so much time with him and such important time that it's just hard to believe that, you know, it's not going to be anymore.
Well, we're going to spend a couple of programs recycling our two interviews with Dick Stahl that we did years ago, really, near the beginning of this program. We have one that initiated the conversation, and then we resumed it about a year later on the publication of his last book. We also have some tributes to him along the way, and after we do these two programs, we're going to spend some time with poetry that seems to fit the time, the occasion, not only Dick Stahl's passing, but the situation we find ourselves in. We are all somewhat isolated right now, and even here in the studio, I can just get a glimpse of Roald between two displays. But that's the way it has to be for a while. And then when we finish those three programs, then we're going to launch into some reruns. Things dealing with the canon, how to write, things of that sort, until we get to a somewhat more settled time. But right now, we begin our tribute to Dick Stahl by going back to that first conversation. Dick, I've read your poetry for a long time. Matter of fact, when we were publishing Communique magazine,
we published some
of your poems.
We certainly did.
And talking to Roald one day, he says, Dick has changed.
Well, he has become, for reasons that I'm anxious to ask him about, sort of the official occasional poem writer of the Quad Cities. I think every poet has written an occasional poem for a friend's wedding or something, but Dick is making a habit out of it, has for probably the last 10 years. A lot of what he writes are poems that open a library or dedicated Old Main or whatever.
You want to define occasional poem for me?
Yeah, a poem whose impetus comes from the outside, not inspiration from the inside. The Fairmont Library is going to be dedicated. Dick, could you write a poem for that? And Dick writes a poem for that. And in fact, I warned you that Dick writes so fast that once he found out he was going to be on Scribble yesterday, he could probably write a poem about an occasional poem for Scribble. And you didn't believe me, but
there it is.
Listen to this.
Here it is.
We'll deal with that in a minute.
Okay.
How long have you been writing poetry, Dick?
Oh, boy. 1970, 70-some in there, I would think.
What motivated you?
I don't know. Roald Tweet inspired me. Let's put it that way.
Oh, he's responsible for so many.
I wrote a poem for one of his classes in English literature on Anglo-Saxon poetry. And I thought, well, let's give it a try. And I did. And he read it in class. And ever since then, I've been writing.
So, Roald, you're responsible for unleashing... he's responsible for me writing a book. I mean, that's how dangerous he can be.
Dangerous.
Well, Turnabout is fair play. You're responsible for Rock Island Lines.
Yes. Most people don't know that I really wanted to do that program myself, but I am not stupid. I figured that's going to take a lot of work. And who's the guy, you know, who's better positioned to do it? And Roel Tweet. And so I had the fun of listening to him as we recorded. And that was my payback. We had a lot of fun, and you still do occasional batches of Rock Island Lines.
I still do a few, yeah.
Yeah. But, Dick, occasional poetry. Pindar was the Greek poet I know who would write poems to celebrate Olympic victories and things mm-hmm. of that sort.
Yeah, an ode is generally an occasional poem. Most mm-hmm. odes are.
Okay. Ode to a Grecian urn?
Sure.
Okay.
He's standing there looking at a Grecian urn.
So it can be just a personal reaction to something.
It can. Usually it is not, right? And what Dick is here for are the public occasions that he writes for, which is, you know, everything from the symphony to the dedication of Old Main.
I will just note you're shifting your definition of occasional.
Well, yeah.
Poem, but that's okay.
I never...
Give us an example of one of your occasional poems.
Well, you mentioned the Quad City Symphony Orchestra, and they just celebrated their centennial year, 100 years. And so Ben Loeb asked me to write 6 poems, one for each of the masterworks, which I did, and then one for Yo-Yo Ma. He was the grand finale at the end there. So the first poem that I wrote was for Dvorak. And so I'd been to Spillville before, but then my wife said, I think we better go back to Spillville, and we did, and we had a wonderful time and learned a lot. In fact, it was much easier to write this poem after we had been there. We went to the Turkey River. We went to the his house there, his home there, the museum, the park there. And so anyway, can I read this one for you then?
Yeah.
It's called Come Home, Dvorak, Come Home. You're invited home again for the centennial season's Masterworks 1. Most popular of composers since 1920, you affirm those new world sounds, like Bohemia, like Spillville. Your music breathes the tonic of the fresh Midwestern air of the new world. Your Symphony No. 9 defines how we got here, who we are as Americans. Old country, new country merge into the spirit of this landscape and its settlers. Mix the exuberant Czech rhapsodies with the open spaces of these rolling Iowa hills, echoing Native American rhythms, the Negro spirituals, and you too sing, like the Scarlet Tanager spiriting the Turkey River over rocks. It's all about panache, about passion, for a haunting English horn solo, for a whiff of prairie smoke and shooting star hosting bees and butterflies, for beauty, for home again.
Very good. And I think one of the hallmarks of an occasional poem, at least for a public occasion like that, is bringing in all different elements, mm-hmm. celebrating all, and you put in all the elements that go into Dvorak's music. Does it take research to do...
Yes, it does take research. And we, my wife and I had to research all of the six masterworks, including this one. But it was a little easier for me, as I said, because we went to the place and we saw the Turkey River and we walked in the park. And I think we talked to the people in the museum and they said, now, don't forget to put the Scarlet Tanager in the poem. And I said, I sure Here it is. So I fulfilled my job.
Well, how much research did you have to do on us to write them? An ode on this.
An ode
program.
On Scribbles?
Yes.
Well,
let's hear that, and then we can
okay,
talk about
let's
it.
Hear this
we'll
one.
Okay,
we'll revel in the praise.
Okay, we'll revel.
He may take a more objective view of this program.
No, not Dick. Dick is 100% praise.
Okay. 100%. Okay. The poem is called On Scribbles. The epigraph for Don Wooten at WVIK Tuesday, October 6th, 2015. It's the clickety-clack cadence of the typewriter keys at the top of your show that features a sliding carriage struck by letters for that first lightning line's measured count that rings a bell. This little song starts a half sonnet, a furious home row dance of postures and pirouettes that invites your guests to share their call, their craft, their ingenuity and composition over WVIK. Creativity works new sounds for a new music. Your program's my typewriter point, a lofty rise of revered spoken words by Garrison Keillor on the writer's almanac and his trademark line. Here's a poem for today. Good reads live on scribbles like a sonnet sequence that keeps on singing in titles and tomes long after the rhetorical flourish complements a little bell ringing.
Very nice.
See, he could do it.
Yeah, he can do it.
I mean, he probably could have done three.
Well, if our program had more substance.
I know. Well, the question I continually have, and I bugged you about it, I guess, before, Dick, almost every poet I know in the Quad Cities and nationally, too, has written an occasional poem for a friend's wedding or somebody's retirement,
yes.
For example.
Or birth.
But almost all of them hate to do it and complain about having to do it and don't think it's very worthwhile doing because it's so ephemeral. You know, the minute the library is opened, the poem's gone, right? It's a poem of the moment. Whereas, poetry should live on. What intrigues you about occasional poetry?
I would challenge you before he answers that. What makes you think the poem doesn't live on?
Well, okay, it does occasionally. Bells for John Whiteside's Daughter is a great poem by John Cole Ransom. But by and large, you know, the poet Wordsworth and Tennyson, after they became poets laureates of England, really did very little that still lives on because they were so busy doing occasional poems.
Okay. Now you may ask the question.
Okay. So what is the mystique for you among all the poets in the Quad Cities of occasional poetry?
Well, I think I got into this many years ago in the 80s, as I mentioned. I wanted to write a poem that would kind of commemorate or define or illustrate or something the careers of instructors and teachers at Central High School. And one of my favorites was Jim Fox, and he was my gym teacher. And I think he was nearing retirement, and I thought, well, maybe I should do this, and then maybe I shouldn't do this, you know, get up in front of the auditorium, you know, filled with the faculty and read a poem. But I did. And that was the start of it. Orville Kaler, the assistant principal, I think, was part of that also. I wrote a poem for him. And after that point, I just kept going on. And some of the teachers that worked there had been teaching there for 30 years and 40 years. And I just thought that maybe at the end a poem would be kind of nice to...
But I think when you became Poet Laureate, you were the first Quad Cities Poet Laureate.
Yes.
When was that, in 2000 or something like that? 2001.
Yeah.
You really took the job seriously, and as you went around to the various townships reading mm-hmm. poetry, you would almost always write an occasional poem for that particular occasion.
And, yes.
And I think that probably maybe have whetted your appetite, but that's when I really noticed that you more and more shifted over to you know, 80% of your effort is occasional poetry.
But do you still write things that just come from you?
I do. Yes, I write poems that I'm trying to... What am I writing about now? I'm writing about the planet Pluto and an electric cream separator. So, I mean, that's kind
of... Well, why don't you read that? That's
okay.
A good one, too.
Okay. This has to do with, the flyby of Pluto and so on. So the poem is called Pluto and the Electric Cream Separator. for the New Horizons flyby of Pluto, July 14th, 2015. When you build a mount for your next telescope out of scrap from a cream separator, it's going to turn around on you. Take Streeter, Illinois-born youth-turned-amateur astronomer Clyde Tombaugh. He found something suitable in this squat machine, maybe in its 50 plates, arranged by number, in its stability for his later watching dots move at the Lowell Observatory the day he discovered Pluto. At Woggy's Dairy, my mother calibrated her separator like an astronomer. Her eyes timed the spin cycle of its Milky Way, its closed orbit of centrifugal force, its moving points of light pouring from one spigot, skim milk, into a 5-gallon can, and from the other, shiny as stainless steel, rich, smooth cream, into the dark underworld of her first morning cup of black coffee, now properly blended.
That's an interesting juxtaposition.
Yes, see, and that, to me, that keeps it from being an occasional poem, a standard occasional poem, because it really comes back to something personal. The flyby of Pluto brings him back, you know, not way ahead in the future, but way back into the past, by way of a cream separator, which brings together instead of separates.
Have you ever written a poem about the roll tweet?
He has.
Yes, yes.
You have?
On your retirement, I know that. I did that.
Really?
You
did.
And Margaret's birthday.
Margaret's birthday.
And your birthday, September 1st.
And you're still welcomed in the social circles?
I hope so. I got to feel well.
Are you, do people ask you now to do that, or do you do this on your own?
Both. Sometimes they ask me, and sometimes I do it as a surprise. I kind of like the surprise element. I kind of like that. But then sometimes once you start that, you kind of – I think one thing, one of the maybe stranger things is I've written for all of our 5 grandkids. And I write the poem within the hour of their birth, within the hour, because I want the family all there. I want, you know, everybody there in the room when I read it. So that's why kind of a self-imposed restriction here. But in some cases, I don't know the sex of the child. I don't know the name. I might have an idea or two, but nothing has been written. And, of course, when it's written longhand. It's written out. So I have the frame. I have the paper. I have the pen that I'm going to use. But it all has to be done within the hour. And then we call the kind of assemble everybody and give a reading.
And you carry on about me making up talks.
I mean, really. Well, you can do that with poetry, pretty much.
But I would think the demands on writing poetry.
I'm not complaining about you being able to just wing it.
No, you're not complaining. You regard it as some kind of marvel. But here's
Dick writes. That's another thing that separates Dick from most other poets. You know, we had Charles Hughes on a couple of weeks ago. Minimum for him between getting the idea and finishing the poem is 6 weeks.
Yeah.
He said he can't. It just takes that long of work and work and work and work.
When you write an occasional poem, do you ever go back and redo it?
Yes. Yes, I do.
What kind of occasion is that? You're revisiting the occasion.
But I don't want to monkey too much with it or tinker too much, right? I don't want to do that because then sometimes the spontaneity is gone. I mean, at the time I wrote it, wow. But then 6 weeks later, well, let's see, what did I write? Well, that doesn't sound too good. Maybe we can, you know, but then pretty soon what you're doing is you're, you know, the action verbs are gone and the state of being verbs come back and something is or was or, you know, and so you don't want to lose that. You want to kind of keep that alive. And so, anyway.
Well, you are a poet of a different kind, I must say. That's extraordinary.
It is.
Are you planning? You have some surprises you're going to hatch later on? Or
you've got a book in the works. Why don't you quickly describe that?
Well, the
that?
Book is on the bluffs of the upper Mississippi. And my wife and I have climbed the 24 publicly accessible bluffs. I mentioned publicly accessible because the other ones have rattlesnakes in them, and I'm kind of scared of that. But we would climb these bluffs, and then we would look out over the river, and in all seasons of the year, in all months of the year, it's in all times of day, sometimes in the morning and sometimes, you know, in the afternoon, at high noon, in the evening almost. And so as we look down at the river's doing its thing. Is it turning left? Is it elbowing? What's it doing? Is that the river there? That's the main channel. Or that's a backwater there. Or that's a slough. Or that's an island. Well, how come that island still looks the same as it did yesterday, you know? And so how do you capture the Mississippi, and the river, you know? And then sometimes we can stand on one bluff and see another bluff. So I could kind of stair-step up the Mississippi by poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of possibilities with that.
When is that book coming out?
Well, we don't know. I wish I knew. I don't know.
And that's pretty much the substance of our first interview with Dick Stahl some years ago. And he talks about a book that he was working on. And next week, we will repeat our conversation with him about his book called Bluffing. An amazing fellow. And just to think, Tweet, you're responsible.
I know it, and I don't take responsibility for everything I'm accused of, but I do remember the moment in class. I was a brand new teacher, must have been 1962 or so, when he took a survey of English literature, the first term, which started with Anglo-Saxon poetry. I had no assignments, I had no lectures done, so I fudged it, you know, the way a beginning teacher does for a few years. And I thought, this would be a fun assignment. Why don't I have my students write 10 lines of Anglo-Saxon poetry? Anglo-Saxon poetry is different from what we regard today as poetry by having two beats, a pause, and then two beats. Bump, bump, pause, bump, 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 bump. Military, you know, so I thought it would be fun for students to try out actually to write, and it alliterates a lot with heavy alliteration. Dick turned in one of the poems that I thought was really good, not just because it fulfilled the assignment of doing an Anglo-Saxon poem, but it was really a good poem. So I read it to the class, which took another little bit of time for which I didn't have to prepare, right? First 5 years of teaching is hard. And I read it in class, and I can see still today, close my eyes and see the look on Dick's face when I started reading the poem. And literally, I think that's the moment in which he suddenly realized, I mean, the light bulb went on, and he suddenly realized, I can write poetry. You know, I don't know what he'd intended to do before that. He had come to Augustana after a couple of other career changes that he decided not to do. And I don't know if he'd even decided to be an English major at that point. But that was it. And from then on, I knew him, and I knew the poetry he started to write. And the rest is history.
It's not often that a teacher gets to realize the effect that he or she may have had in a class.
No.
I remember once I was teaching poetry at Alleman, and I decided, okay, I've talked about poetry being a hand grenade that explodes into all sorts of meanings, so I took a couple of lines from Gerard Manley Hopkins about how civilization has just kind of plastered over the earth. I can't recall the lines on Norkin Footfield being shod, all is bleared, smeared with trade.
An Anglo-Saxon line, yeah. By the way.
But and that was it. It was an exhausting class and just went at it, hammer and tongs. And then later on I was talking to one of the women who worked in the cafeteria, and her brother was in the class. And she said, driving to work this morning, my brother was sitting in the passenger seat staring out the window. And he suddenly said, we are so lucky to live in the country that we can see how nature changes. And it was all stuff we talked about
right,
in class.
Right.
And I thought, that is the only right. instance in my life.
No, you don't get many of those.
No, you don't. And it, you suddenly think, this job is worth it.
Right.
But Dick Stahl is, you know, I wonder about his occasional poetry.
I've spent most of my time with him making fun of him for doing it. But I guess I would have to say secretly and a little bit too late, I've changed my mind because it doesn't seem to me that his occasional poetry is that different. Here's what I think Dick's poetry is all about. You're mentioning Gerard Manley Hopkins reminded me of it. Gerard Manley Hopkins was a Jesuit priest who wrote at the end of the 19th century poetry that was, from the Catholics' point of view, subversive for a while. Took him a while to get it published, but totally out of context with the usual poetry. He went back to harsh Anglo-Saxon heavy rhythms and so forth. Beautiful poetry. And one of Dick's favorite poets, too. Here's what Gerard Manley Hopkins says the poet does. A Sunday painter goes out and sets up his easel and paints the landscape. What's there? The trees, the stream coming from left to right into the center of the painting and so forth. But what the poet does, what Hopkins says he does, is inscape.
Uh-huh.
I want to capture what's inside, what's within, the heart, the glowing heart. It's like a fire that's been banked. It's all gray ash, and you think there's no life there. And then suddenly, one of the logs gives way, and everything opens up scarlet and glowing.
Yeah.
Okay, what Dick tries to do in all of his poetry, I think, is start with the details, events of the river and the working river, and then look for the mystery, look for the heart. Mm-hmm. I think he does, you heard the occasional poems that he read. He always starts out with information. This happened in 1974, and this was done by this. It took 10 months to do, and so forth. But boy, by the time you get to the end of the poem, you know, you're high up there, inscape. So I would say that Dick Stahl, like Gerard Manley Hopkins, is above all a poet of inscape. What he's looking for is not the working Mississippi River. It's the mythic river of Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. Dick describes it as magic. To me, it's far more than magic. It's spiritual. It's other things like that.
Mm-hmm. An extraordinary man, and he is obviously very much missed because many people have written tributes to him since his death. And we will look at some of those next week, but for right now, we have to head for the exit. We want to thank Dick Stahl for leaving us such a wonderful fund of poetry. And we thank you as well for joining us. We'll be back again next week as we continue our series of remembering Dick Stahl on Scribble.